myself an opportunity to set down what I know about cycles, and because I enjoy writing, but mainly, as I said above, to help the reader deal with the market's ups and downs. In the preceding pages, I have covered many of the considerations that bear on the process of understanding cycles, as well as the vagaries that properly restrain the confidence anyone should have regarding his ability to do so. My goal here is to repeat these considerations and sum up. Investing, as I've said, consists of positioning capital so as to benefit from future events. I also said we never know what the future holds, and thus where we're going. But we should do all we can to know where we stand, since the current position of the cycle has powerful implications for how we should cope with its possible future. Where we stand in cycles has a profound influence on the future tendencies, on what is likely to happen, and perhaps even when. As I discussed in Chapter 1, and illustrated in the last chapter, our cycle positioning shifts the probability distribution governing the future. Many things can happen. We know we face uncertainty and risk. All we can know about the future, at best, is what the probabilities are. Knowing the probabilities can help us be more right than others on average. But it's essential to remember that knowing the probabilities is far from the same as knowing precisely what's going to happen. We generally have no choice but to be content with knowing the probabilities. But the sample in terms of each outcome, for example, each year's GDP growth or each stock's gain next year, will often be limited to one observation, one experience, meaning many things can happen, but only one will. There won't be enough observations to allow us to assume that the future reality will be the one the probabilities say is most likely, and certainly not that the most likely thing will happen anytime soon. For example, let's take the correction of a euphoria-driven bubble. Theoretically, it doesn't have to happen, ever. But the realities of cycles say that A, it will happen eventually, and B, the more time that passes without it happening, and the longer the cycle continues to move upward, the more likely, and usually the more imminent, the expected correction becomes. Of course, the more time that passes before this logical event occurs, and the further that the cycle swings in the upward direction, the more people will conclude that the rules of cycles have been somehow suspended, and that the called-for correction will never happen. This can lead to the kind of buying we saw in 2000, and eventually to an extremely painful outcome. We have to safeguard our portfolios and our investment management businesses against the danger stemming from the fact that the thing that's most likely to happen, which our understanding of cycles can tell us, may not happen until long after it first becomes likely. And we have to steel ourselves emotionally so as to be able to live through the potentially long time lag between reaching a well-reasoned conclusion and having it turn out to be correct. How about a bit of history? In the late 1990s, a highly experienced money manager, for whom I have great respect, reached the conclusion that tech stocks were highly overvalued. His reasoning was solid, based on an effective interpretation of the relevant data, and he was right. However, it took years before the market proved him right. And as one of the most important investment adages says, being too far ahead of your time is indistinguishable from being wrong. The fact that this manager's conclusion was well-founded did him only limited good. In the period before the correction finally began, much of the capital under his management was withdrawn. The good news is that the same keen intellect that had led him to his ultimately correct conclusion, combined with the addition of a healthy dose of ego strength, enabled him to stick to his guns. He held to his cautious position, rather than capitulate and buy in higher, as so many did. Eventually, he was proved right, and he fully recovered regarding both his reputation and his assets under management. But the interim he lived through was certainly painful. Fast forward to fall 2017, and now he's done it again. He reached the conclusion that U.S. stocks would show low returns, and he reduced his holdings, causing him to miss some of the subsequent gains. Some of his clients have bailed again, and his firm's assets again have declined by a significant percentage in a rising market as of this writing. Is his reasoning right again? Will he again be proved right by future events? Will a correction come soon enough for him to enjoy the benefits of being right? Is he a permabear, who fortunately is validated once in a while? Or is he a brilliant tactician who's right in principle, but so far has been thwarted by the undependability of cause and effect in the investment world? These questions are largely unanswerable. But the most important thing is for the reader to note this key lesson. Positioning for cycles isn't easy. Secondary lesson, be careful about betting too heavily on your opinions, no matter how well supported you think they are. In my opinion, it's entirely reasonable to try to improve long-term investment results by altering positions on the basis of an understanding of the market cycle. But it's essential that you also understand the limitations, as well as the skills that are required and how difficult it is. Importantly, I want to call attention to the obvious fact that, rather than the everyday ups and downs of the market, the clear examples I provided in Chapter 12 all concerned once-in-a-lifetime cyclical extremes, which these days seem to happen about once a decade. First, the extremes of bubble and crash, and in particular the process through which they arise, most clearly illustrate the cycle in action and how to respond to it. And second, it's when dealing with pronounced extremes that we should expect the highest likelihood of success. Here's how I think about the impact of market movements on the investment environment we work in. It's admittedly a simplistic vision, and it suggests a world that is discernible and much more regular than the real one. But it has worked for me for decades as a general framework, and it beats the heck out of trying to understand the world as a series of irregular, random zigs and zags. Between the extremes of rich and cheap, when the cycle is in the middle ground of fair, the state of relationship between price and value is, by definition, nowhere as clear-cut as at the extremes. As a result, it's hard to make frequent distinctions, and hard to do so correctly. Thus, distinctions in the middle ground aren't as potentially profitable as at the extremes, and those distinctions can't be expected to work out as dependably. Detecting and exploiting the extremes is really the best we can hope for, and I believe it can be done dependably, if you're analytical, insightful, experienced, or well-versed in history, and unemotional. That means, however, that you shouldn't expect to reach profitable conclusions daily, monthly, or even yearly. We can't create great opportunities to time the market through our understanding of cycles. Rather, the market will decide when we'll have them. Remember, when there's nothing clever to do, the mistake lies in trying to be clever. The reasonableness of the effort at cycle timing depends simply on what you expect of it. If you frequently try to discern where we are in the cycle, in the sense of what's going to happen tomorrow or what's in store for us next month, you're unlikely to find success. I describe such an effort as trying to be cute. No one can make fine distinctions like those often enough or consistently right enough to add materially to investment results. And no one knows when the market developments that efforts at cycle positioning label profitable will materialize. On the other hand, positioning portfolios for the major cycles has been a big contributor to Oaktree's success. My colleagues and I became aggressive in 1990 to 93, 2002 and 2008, and we turned cautious and pulled in our horns in 1994 to 95 and 2005 to 06, and to some extent in the last few years. We have tried to use the cycle to our advantage and to add value for our clients, and I'd say we got the positioning largely right on those occasions. Also, there weren't any major opportunities to do so that we missed. So thus far, our major cycle calls have all proved correct. The word all makes it sound like this is a battle that's consistently winnable. but my personal all consists of 4 or 5 times in 48 years. By making my calls only at the greatest cyclical extremes, I've maximized my chances of being right. No one, and certainly not I, can succeed regularly, other than perhaps at extremes. So please note, as I always try to remind people, that it's not easy, and I don't want to give the impression that readers should expect to find it easy, or be disappointed when they don't. As I said in On the Couch, January 2016, I want to make it abundantly clear that when I call for caution in 2006-07, or active buying in late 2008, or renewed caution in 2012, or a somewhat more aggressive stance here in early 2016, I do it with considerable uncertainty. My conclusions are the result of my reasoning, applied with the benefit of my experience and collaboration with my Oak Tree colleagues, but I never consider them 100% likely to be correct, or even 80%. I think they're right, of course, but I always make my recommendations with trepidation. I read the same newspapers as everyone else. I see the same economic data. I'm buffeted by the same market movements. The same factors appeal to my emotions. Maybe I'm a little more confident in my reasoning, and certainly I have more experience than most. But the key is that, for whatever reason, I'm able to stand up to my emotions and follow my conclusions. None of my conclusions can be documented or proved. If they could be, most intelligent people would reach the same conclusions, with the same degree of confidence. I tell you this only to communicate my feeling that no one should fear he's not up to the task just because he's unsure of his conclusions. These aren't things about which certainty is attainable. Peter Bernstein contributed some useful wisdom on this subject. I'll conclude this chapter with his thoughts. After 28 years at this post and 22 years before this in money management, I can sum up whatever wisdom I have accumulated this way. The trick is not to be the hottest stock picker, the winningest forecaster, or the developer of the neatest model. Such victories are transient. The trick is to survive. Performing that trick requires a strong stomach for being wrong, because we are all going to be wrong more often than we expect. The future is not ours to know. But it helps to know that being wrong is inevitable and normal, not some terrible tragedy, not some awful failing in reasoning, not even bad luck in most instances. Being wrong comes with the franchise of an activity whose outcome depends on an unknown future. Jeff Sought, Being Wrong and Still Making Money, Seeking Alpha, March 13, 2017. Chapter 16, The Cycle in Success. The important lesson is that, especially in an interconnected, informed world, everything that produces unusual profitability will attract incremental capital until it becomes overcrowded and fully institutionalized, at which point its prospective risk-adjusted return will move toward the mean, or worse. And correspondingly, things that perform poorly for a while eventually will become so cheap, due to their relative depreciation and the lack of investor interest, that they'll be primed to outperform. Cycles like these hold the key to success in investing, not trees that everyone is assuming will grow to the sky. Hopefully, you're now equipped for the task of recognizing, assessing, and responding to cycles. That can contribute substantially to your investment success. But as Peter Bernstein said, even the best investors won't be successful all the time. Understanding that is an important part of being able to live with the effort. Success, like the other things mentioned in this book, comes and goes. In fact, over the course of my career, I've detected a cycle in success. To a large degree, the ebb and flow of success, like the other cycles I've described, stems from the role played by human nature. And once again, each development in the cycle leads to the next. I've long held the conviction I mentioned previously, and it's been strongly reinforced over my 29 years of involvement with distressed debt and distressed companies, that success carries within itself the seeds of failure, and failure, the seeds of success. Peter Kaufman, Charlie Munger's biographer and the CEO of Glenair, an exceptional producer of aerospace components, describes the workings of dialectical materialism as follows. As any system grows toward its maximum or peak efficiency, it will develop the very internal contradictions and weaknesses that bring about its eventual decay and demise. His essay number 49, The Perpetual Seesaw, 2010. This captures the process that guarantees that success will prove cyclical. The role of human nature. Another way I put it is that success isn't good for most people. In short, success can change people, and usually not for the better. Success makes people think they're smart. That's fine as far as it goes, but there can also be negative ramifications. Success also tends to make people richer, and that can lead to a reduction in their level of motivation. In investing, there's a complex relationship between humility and confidence. Since the greatest bargains are usually found among things that are undiscovered or disrespected, to be successful, an investor has to have enough confidence in his judgment to adopt what David Swensen, the hugely successful head of Yale's high-performing endowment, describes as uncomfortably idiosyncratic portfolios, which frequently appear downright imprudent in the eyes of conventional wisdom. Pioneering Portfolio Management, 2000. By definition, pronounced bargain prices are most likely to be found among things that conventional wisdom dismisses, that make most investors uncomfortable, and whose merits are hard to comprehend. Investing in them requires considerable inner strength. When one of those positions initially fails to rise, as the investor expects, or perhaps goes in the opposite direction, the investor has to have enough confidence to hold on to his position or even add to it. He can't take a price decline as a sure sell signal. In other words, it can't be his default position that the market knows more than he does. But, on the other hand, the investor also has to know his limitations and not assume he's infallible. He has to understand that no one knows for sure what the macro future holds. While he's likely to have opinions regarding the future course of economies, markets, and interest rates, he should acknowledge that they're not necessarily correct. And, counter to the above, he mustn't always assume that he's right and the market's wrong, and thus hold or add without limitation and without rechecking his facts and his reasoning. That's hubris. As successes accrue, it's common for people to conclude that they're smart, and after making a lot of money in a strongly rising market, they decide they've got investing mastered. Their faith increases in their own opinions and instinct. Their investing comes to reflect less self-doubt, meaning they think less about the possibility of being wrong and worry less about the risk of loss. This can cause them to no longer insist on the full margin of safety that gave rise to their earlier successes. This is the reason for one of the oldest and most important investment adages: don't confuse brains with a bull market. The plain truth is, there's little of value to be learned from success. People who are successful run the risk of overlooking the fact that they were lucky or that they had help from others. In investing, success teaches people that making money is easy and that they don't have to worry about risk, two particularly dangerous lessons. They may conclude that the small opportunity that gave them their big winner is infinitely scalable, which most are not. And many people, including investors who became famous for having had a single success, conclude that they can branch out into any number of other fields, that the intelligence that produced that first epic success must be broadly applicable. Factors like these make investment success hard to replicate, meaning it can prove cyclical rather than serial. In fact, rather than imply that another is coming, one success may in and of itself make a second one less probable. I'll quote Henry Kaufman, formerly Salomon Brothers' chief economist. There are two kinds of people who lose a lot of money: those who know nothing and those who know everything. Archimedes on Wall Street, Forbes, October 19th, 1998. It's not for nothing that there are famous jinxes, such as showing up on the cover of Sports Illustrated or Forbes magazine. A cover appearance can be the result of a singular accomplishment that may have resulted from a lucky break, a unique, non-replicable opportunity, or the bearing of imprudent risk. Or the good outcomes that land people on a magazine cover, including the successful investors lauded by Forbes, may cause them to become more confident and cocksure, and less disciplined and hardworking. Not much of a formula for success. The role of popularity. One of the principal ways in which success carries the seeds of investment failure is through increased popularity. I wrote just before that bargains are most often found among those things that are hard to comprehend, uncomfortable and easily dismissed by the crowd. Short-term investment performance is largely a popularity contest. And most bargains exist for the simple reason that they haven't yet been taken up by the herd and become popular. On the contrary, assets that have performed well are usually the ones that have gained in popularity because of their obvious merit and thus have become high-priced. Let's think about investment strategies. It's essential to grasp that nothing will work forever. No approach, rule, or process can outperform all the time. First, most securities and approaches are right for certain environments and parts of the cycle, and wrong for others. And second, past success will in itself render future success less likely. In the 1960s, when the idea of investing in stocks was first gaining popularity among Americans, the emphasis was on industry leaders and so-called blue-chip securities. Small capitalization stocks were largely overlooked at first, but eventually they were noticed and bought. This caused them to do better than large caps. When people noticed small cap stocks' superior returns in this catch-up phase, their buying produced further gains for them, until it caused them to be fully priced relative to large caps. At that point, interest rotated to large caps, which then regained the lead. Likewise, growth and tech stocks did far better than more mundane value stocks in the late 1990s. This divergence reached a maximum in 1999, with growth stocks outperforming value stocks that year by almost 25 percentage points. But growth stocks' dramatic outperformance rendered them overpriced. And when the stock market corrected in 2000 to 2002, they lost far more than value stocks, which previously had languished cheap. In other words, outperformance is just another word for one thing appreciating relative to another. And clearly, that can't go on forever. Regardless of how great its merits may be, A is unlikely to be infinitely more valuable than B. That means if A keeps appreciating relative to B, there has to be a point at which it will become overvalued relative to B. And just when the last person gives up on B, because it's been performing so poorly, and jumps to A, it will be time for B, now compellingly cheap relative to A, to outperform. Strong forces create a tendency for strategies, investors or investment management firms that succeed for a while to cease doing so. I wrote just above that most ideas aren't infinitely scalable. One essential truth about investing is that, generally speaking, good results will bring more money to hot money managers and strategies, and if allowed to grow unchecked, more money will bring bad performance. In the mid-2000s, convertible arbitrage rapidly gained in popularity. Investors without a view on the prospects for a given stock were willing to buy bonds convertible into it, as long as they were able to short the underlying shares in an appropriate hedge ratio. See my memo, A Case in Point, June 2005. Convertible arbitrageurs reported outstanding risk-adjusted returns in all kinds of market environments, until so much money and so many competitors were attracted to the strategy that no one could find positions as attractively priced as those of the past. The important lesson is that, especially in an interconnected, informed world, everything that produces unusual profitability will attract incremental capital until it becomes overcrowded and fully institutionalized, at which point its prospective risk-adjusted return will move toward the mean, or worse. and correspondingly, things that perform poorly for a while eventually will become so cheap due to their relative depreciation and the lack of investor interest that they'll be primed to outperform. Cycles like these hold the key to success in investing, not trees that everyone is assuming will grow to the sky. It's all a matter of ebb and flow. In investing, things work until they don't. Or as Ajit Jain of Berkshire Hathaway told me about investing the other day, it's easy until it isn't. Cheap small caps outperform until they reach the point where they're no longer cheap. Trend following or momentum investing, staying with the winners, works for a while. But eventually rotation and buying the laggards takes over as the winning strategy. Buying the dips lets investors take advantage of momentary weakness up until the time when a major problem surfaces or the market simply no longer recovers, causing price declines to be followed by further price declines, not quick rebounds. Risky assets outperform, coming from valuations where they were excessively penalized for their riskiness, until they're priced more like safe assets. Then they underperform, until they once again offer adequate risk premiums. The bottom line is clear. Nothing works forever. But it's essential to recognize that when everyone becomes convinced that something will keep working forever, that's the very time when it'll become certain not to. I say, in investing, everything that's important is counterintuitive, and everything that's obvious to everyone is wrong. Perhaps the greatest example of the influence of popularity, in reverse, was seen in 1979, and few investors who were around at the time have forgotten it. On August 13th of that year, after almost a decade of painfully poor performance on the part of stocks, Business Week magazine published a cover story entitled The Death of Equities. Its conclusion, that stocks were done for, was based on the opposite of everything recommended in this book. The article cited a litany of reasons why the poor performance of stocks would continue unabated. 7 million people had given up on investing in stocks. Many other forms of investment had done better. Pension funds were turning to hard assets, like gold. Inflation had sapped corporations' ability to increase profits. It went on. Even institutions that have so far remained in the financial markets are pouring money into short-term investments and such alternate equity investments as mortgage-backed paper, foreign securities, venture capital, leases, guaranteed insurance contracts, indexed bonds, stock options, and futures. And here was its conclusion. Today, the old attitude of buying solid stocks as a cornerstone for one's life savings and retirement has simply disappeared, says a young U.S. executive. Have you been to an American stockholders meeting lately? They're all old fogies. The stock market is just not where the action's at. In short, what the death of equities said was that stocks had become so unpopular that they would never do well again. It takes a highly simplistic first-level thinker to conclude that poor past performance has led to unpopularity today, which implies poor performance tomorrow. Rather, the insightful second-level thinker says poor past performance has led to unpopularity today, which implies low prices today, which in turn implies good performance tomorrow. The Death of Equities was published just a few years before, and in essence laid out the entire case for, the 1982 kickoff of the greatest bull market in history. At the time it was published, the S&P 500 stood at 107, and in March of 2000, it reached 1,527. That's a price gain of more than 14 times, or 13.7% per year for almost 21 years. And those figures ignore dividends, which took the total gain to more than 28 times, and the annualized total return to 17.6%. The lesson is simple. Investors should be leery of popular assets. Rather, it's unpopularity that is the buyer's friend. The role of companies. Companies, too, are subject to ups and downs in terms of success, also based on a series of cause and effect events. One of the most pronounced such processes I've witnessed took place at Xerox. The office copying giant, the first to make it possible to avoid the wet process of photostatting, which required the documents be sent out to a photo lab to be duplicated, was one of the first companies I visited as a rookie office equipment analyst in the late 1960s. At that time, Xerox had a monopoly on dry copying and appeared to be in full command of its destiny. My senior analyst and I used to meet with Xerox's analyst contact, and for each copier model in the product line, he would help us triangulate on the company's projections in terms of the number of machines it would have in the field in the coming year and the annual rental revenue per machine. Because of Xerox's dominant market position, it was largely able to make those projections come true. It could charge monopolistic prices that enabled it to fine-tune the size of its rental fleet, and that gave it very high profit margins. It also insisted on a rental-only model, refusing to sell or lease its machines and lose control of them. What a perpetual motion machine. But Xerox management may have ignored the possibility that those high margins would prove unsustainable. In 1975, Xerox resolved an antitrust complaint over control of the copier market by entering into a consent decree, requiring it to make its powerful portfolio of patents available for licensing. Competitors began to produce and sell their own copiers. They were able to undercut Xerox's prices and displace part of its rental population. This reduced Xerox's U.S. market share in copiers from nearly 100% to the low teens, and it ate significantly into Xerox's profits. As the incumbent, Xerox had trouble responding to the price competition, as this would cannibalize its existing business. The competitors did so in an early example of what's now called disruption. In 1968, thanks to its monopolistic position, strong growth, and high profitability, Xerox was a leader of the Nifty 50 I described earlier. Companies that were considered so strong and so fast-growing that nothing bad could happen, and no stock price was too high. But trees rarely grow to the sky, and success is rarely unending. Because Xerox's behavior had invited competition that it was unprepared to respond to, and for other reasons as well, by the early years of the 21st century, it was experiencing serious difficulty. Companies, like people, have the potential to respond to success with behavior that dooms that very success. Thus, companies can get complacent and become fat and happy, become bureaucratic and slow-moving, fail to take action to defend their positions, cease to be innovative and non-conforming, and join the crowd of mediocrity, and/or conclude that they can do pretty much anything, and thus venture into areas beyond their competence. In these ways and more, success truly carries the seeds of failure. But the good news, as I said earlier, is that failure also carries the seeds of success. Once under attack, companies can regain their motivation and sense of purpose. They can shed bureaucratic fat and get serious about meeting competition and making money. And in the ultimate form of unsuccess, they can go through bankruptcy, slim down, and shed losing business lines, unprofitable locations, onerous contracts, and burdensome debt. Of course, however, the owners of companies that go into bankruptcy usually lose their entire positions. Thus, Jahan Janjigijian wrote about Xerox in 2002. In 2000, a new management team implemented a number of restructuring initiatives aimed at returning the company to profitability. These included aggressive cost cuts and the elimination of 13,600 positions. Xerox also sold off its Chinese and Hong Kong operations, as well as 50% of Fuji Xerox to Fuji Photofilm. Furthermore, Xerox allowed GE Capital to take over the financing of receivables, for which it already has received $2.7 billion. And Xerox has exited the struggling small office and home office business. In April, Xerox agreed to pay $10 million to settle the SEC's two-year investigation. It later restated all of its past financial results as required under the agreement. Additionally, the company was successful in working with creditors in renegotiating its debt obligations to more manageable terms. Perhaps most important, the company's products are now more competitive in terms of price and quality. Due to the success of these efforts, Xerox returned to profitability sooner than expected. Given significant operational improvements, we think Xerox makes for a compelling buy at current levels. Xerox, back from the brink. Forbes Growth Investor, October 2002. Because companies don't last as long as economies and markets do, the long-term cycle in company success may not take as long either. But over their lifetimes, companies' gains can lead to losses, and losses can lay the groundwork for gains. There is a cycle in business success. The role of timing. Among the factors that can contribute greatly to an individual's or a company's success is timing. Among other things, it helps to get involved in things at an above-average time. That's what put Xerox on the map in the 1960s, and it helped me out as well. In August 1978, shortly after shifting from running Citibank's equity research department to managing bond portfolios, I got the phone call that changed my life. "There's a guy named Milken in California," my boss said, "and he's involved in something called high-yield bonds. A client wants a portfolio of those bonds. Can you figure out what that means?" It was just in 1977 or 1978 that high-yield bond investing had its institutional inception. That's when Michael Milken achieved his first success in convincing investors that it's okay for below-investment-grade companies to issue bonds, and for institutions to buy them if the interest rate is high enough to compensate for the risk. The high-yield universe consisted of less than $3 billion of bonds at the time I first got involved. The vast majority of investing organizations had a rule against buying bonds rated below investment grade, which were commonly called junk bonds, and Moody's categorically rejected B-rated bonds, saying they fail to possess the characteristics of a desirable investment. How could these unpopular bonds not have been underrated bargains? How could early participation not have been a boon? And then a decade later, Bruce Karsh brought his legal skills and strategic insight to my team, complementing Sheldon Stone's expertise in credit, and we organized one of the first distressed debt funds from a major financial institution. What could be more risky, and thus more unseemly, than investing in the debt of companies in bankruptcy, or considered destined for it? To what idea could people be more averse? In other words, where else could as much money be made so safely? In both these instances, and more, I've been lucky to come across asset classes when they were still undiscovered, uncrowded, and thus bargain-priced. There's little that can make investing as easy as having a market largely to oneself. It beats the heck out of trying to wring decent returns from a market that everybody has discovered, figured out, taken to, and crowded into. The latter is far from a formula for success. The latecomer to a now crowded field isn't the wise man in the beginning. Rather, he's more far likely to be the fool in the end. Those of us who've been lucky enough to be early rather than late know, or certainly should know, that our success wasn't all our doing. The times have to cooperate. And that brings me to a great observation from Henry Phipps, the less celebrated partner of Andrew Carnegie and Henry Clay Frick, two of the 19th century's greatest businessmen. In 1899, Phipps wrote as follows: "Good times, like the present, make bad times, a law sure as the swing of the pendulum. We have experience to know these elementary truths. Have we the sense to put them into practice?" George Harvey, Henry Clay Frick, The Man, 2002. As with people whose successes may constitute isolated instances, rather than indicators of great things to come, as they might be wont to believe, the times may not remain conducive to continued success. Good times can encourage investment decisions that depend on the perpetuation of such times in order to succeed. But those good times can lead instead to bad times that test the decisions in ways they can't withstand. Not only are good times followed sooner or later by bad times, but, as with so many other examples of cycles, good times often produce bad times. Good times can lead to unwise debt issuance, as we saw in the discussion of the distressed debt cycle, or to overbuilding, as we saw in the discussion of the real estate cycle. Likewise, as Ruchir Sharma, chief global strategist at Morgan Stanley Investment Management, wrote in his book, The Rise and Fall of Nations, regarding the effect of fresh new reformers, reform leads to growth and good times, and good times encourage an arrogance and complacency that leads to a new crisis. Phipps pointed out that history shows these trends clearly. The key question is whether we are astute and unemotional enough to know that good times don't necessarily lead to further good times, and thus that success truly can be cyclical. Let's return to Charlie Munger's quote from Demosthenes. For that which a man wishes, that he will believe. In other words, wishful thinking often takes hold. This can cause investors to believe that good times will be followed by more good times. But that ignores the cyclical nature of things, and especially of success. Chapter 17. The Future of Cycles. The tendency of people to go to excess will never end. And thus, since those excesses eventually have to correct, neither will the occurrence of cycles. Economies and markets have never moved in a straight line in the past, and neither will they do so in the future. And that means investors with the ability to understand cycles will find opportunities for profit. Thus far, I've covered a lot of the past and a bit of the present. Now, as I conclude, I want to turn to the future. Over the course of my career, I've witnessed numerous occasions on which pundits said the occurrence of one type of cycle or another had come to an end, whether because of economic vitality, financial innovation, astute corporate management, or the supposed omniscience of central bankers and heads of treasury. They observed that the fluctuations of either the economic cycle or the cycle in profits would be seen no more. I spent some time on this subject in Will It Be Different This Time? November 1996. First, I described a newspaper article that had appeared a few days earlier. It recounted the case currently being made for this remaining a continuous, recession-free economic expansion. As its lead paragraph says, from boardrooms to living rooms, and from government offices to trading floors, a new consensus is emerging. The big, bad business cycle has been tamed. The current expansion, at 67 months, has already far exceeded the post-war average. Nevertheless, 51 of the 53 top economists surveyed by Blue Chip Newsletter, my favorite experts and the subject of my July 1996 memo, The Value of Predictions 2, predict growth next year of 1.5% or more, and the University of Michigan's survey finds that among consumers, more expect 5 more good years than expect bad times to emerge. The chairman of Sears states, there is no natural law that says we have to have a recession. According to Amoco's chairman, I don't see any reason to believe the recovery can't go on until the turn of the century. Sara Lee's CEO says, I don't know what could happen to make a cyclical downturn. The business cycle is tamed, many say, alarming others. Wall Street Journal, November 15, 1996. Clearly, these statements made in 1996 did not truly mark the end of cycles. Rather, there was a modest recession in 2001, and then just a few years later, the Great Recession of 2008 to 2009, the most powerful cyclical event ever experienced by most people alive today. I went on in Will It Be Different This Time? To quote a number of similar assertions from other respected leaders. There will be no interruption of our present prosperity. I cannot help but raise a dissenting voice to the statements that prosperity in this country must necessarily diminish and recede in the future. We are only at the beginning of a period that will go down in history as the Golden Age. The fundamental business of the country is on a sound and prosperous basis. In assessing the reasonableness of these statements, it's important to note that they were made, respectively, by the president of the Pierce Arrow Motor Car Company, the president of the New York Stock Exchange, the president of the Bush Terminal Company, and the president of the United States. The positions of the first and third should serve as a giveaway that these statements came in the distant past, even without your knowing that the president in question was Herbert Hoover. The timing of these statements in 1928 and 1929, on the doorstep of the Great Depression that plagued the world for more than a decade, was less than auspicious. So much, I thought, for prosperity without slowdowns, and for the end of cyclicality. But then, in the 2000s, the expectation of permanent prosperity reared its head again. While not specifically arguing that there would be no more cycles, a lot of investors, bankers, and members of the media certainly embraced the belief that risk was gone. Essentially the same thing. In his autobiography, Stress Test, former Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner describes the climate when he arrived at the Fed in 2003. Economists were starting to debate whether America's long stretch of stability constituted a new normal, a great moderation, a quasi-permanent era of resilience to shocks. There was growing confidence that derivatives and other financial innovations designed to hedge and distribute risk, along with better monetary policy to respond to downturns and better technology to smooth out inventory cycles, had made devastating crises a thing of the past. The fact that this purportedly permanent prosperity was given a name like the Great Moderation suggests it had entered the popular consciousness, and thus it met my requirement for the riskiest possible environment, one in which there's widespread belief that there's no risk. Previously, I described the media accounts to that effect that enumerated the forces that had caused risk's elimination. Fed omniscience, unremitting demand for securities from cash-flow-rich nations, and the latest inventions from Wall Street. Not only were all these cycles all over proclamations wrong, but it's very much worth noting that each of them coincided with, and certainly contributed to, the upward march to a cyclical high, and that the events that followed those highs would be unusually painful. The Great Depression of 1929 to 39, a 3-year stock market decline in 2000 to 02, the first such decline since 1929, and the global financial crisis of 2007 to 08. In Will It Be Different This Time, I went on from recalling the Pollyanna statements just cited to drawing what I think are the essential conclusions on this subject. Of course, what these observations signaled wasn't that cycles wouldn't repeat, but rather that the onlookers had grown too confident. Cycles in economies, companies, and markets will continue to occur, at least as long as people are involved in making the key decisions, which I believe means forever. There is a right time to argue that things will be better, and that's when the market is on its backside, and everyone else is selling things at giveaway prices. It's dangerous when the market's at record levels to reach for a positive rationalization that has never held true in the past. But it's been done before, and it'll be done again. It's different this time are four of the most dangerous words in the business world, especially when applied, as is often the case, to something that has reached what in prior times would have been called an extreme. When people say it's different in this case, what they often mean is that the rules and processes that produced cycles in the past have been suspended, but the cyclical behavior of the financial past did not result from the operation of physical or scientific rules. In science, cause and effect enjoy a dependable and repeatable relationship, so that it's possible to say with confidence, if A, then B. But while there are some principles that operate in the world of finance and business, the resulting truth is very different from that in science. The reason for this, as I've harped on repeatedly, is the involvement of people. People's decisions have great influence on economic, business, and market cycles. In fact, economies, business, and markets consist of nothing but transactions between people. And people don't make their decisions scientifically. Some take history, facts, and data into account, and some approach their decisions as economic men. But even the most unemotional and stoic among them are subject to human influences and the loss of objectivity. Richard Feynman, the noted physicist, wrote, "Imagine how much harder physics would be if electrons had feelings. That is, if electrons had feelings, they couldn't be counted on to always do what science expects of them. So the rules of physics would work only some of the time." The point is that people do have feelings, and as such, they aren't bound by inviolable laws. They'll always bring emotions and foibles to their economic and investing decisions. As a result, they'll become euphoric at the wrong time and despondent at the wrong time, exaggerating the upside potential when things are going well and the downside risk when things are going poorly, and thus they'll take trends to cyclical extremes. A few paragraphs from The Most Important Thing provide a good foundation for a recap of the main points regarding cycles' persistence. The basic reason for the cyclicality in our world is the involvement of humans. Mechanical things can go in a straight line. Time moves ahead continuously. So can a machine when it's adequately powered. But processes in fields like history and economics involve people, and when people are involved, the results are variable and cyclical. The main reason for this, I think, is that people are emotional and inconsistent, not steady and clinical. Objective factors do play a part in cycles, of course. Factors such as quantitative relationships, world events, environmental changes, technological developments, and corporate decisions. But it's the application of psychology to these things that causes investors to overreact or underreact, and thus determines the amplitude of the cyclical fluctuations. When people feel good about the way things are going and optimistic about the future, their behavior is strongly impacted. They spend more and save less. They borrow to increase their enjoyment or their profit potential, even though doing so makes their financial position more precarious. Of course, concepts like precariousness are forgotten in optimistic times, and they become willing to pay more for current value or a piece of the future. Investors tend to look at the processes that are afoot, attribute mechanical dependability to them, rely on that dependability, and extrapolate the processes. What they overlook is the role of emotions. Greed on the upswing and fear on the downswing. Emotions operate on cycles two ways. They magnify the forces that lead to extremes that eventually require correction, and they cause market participants to overlook the cyclicality of cyclical things at just those moments when recognition of excesses is most essential and most potentially profitable. Stage 3 of the bull and bear markets, previously described. The following passage from The Most Important Thing may serve to wrap up regarding the outlook for cycles' recurrence. Cycles will never stop occurring. If there were such a thing as a completely efficient market, and if people really made decisions in a calculating and unemotional manner, perhaps cycles, or at least their extremes, would be banished. But that'll never be the case. Economies will wax and wane as consumers spend more or less, responding emotionally to economic factors or exogenous events, geopolitical or naturally occurring. Companies will anticipate a rosy future during the upcycle and thus overexpand facilities and inventories. These will become burdensome when the economy turns down. Providers of capital will be too generous when the economy is doing well, abetting overexpansion with cheap money, and then they'll pull the reins too tight when things cease to look as good. Investors will overvalue companies when they're doing well and undervalue them when things get difficult. Ignoring cycles and extrapolating trends is one of the most dangerous things an investor can do. People often act as if companies that are doing well will do well forever, and investments that are outperforming will outperform forever, and vice versa. Instead, it's the opposite that is more likely to be true. A deep understanding of emotions and the overdoing they lead to is one of the key bottom lines of this book. Cyclical deviations from the trend line are produced largely by overdoing and its eventual correction. This is obviously true in the securities markets, which are nothing but a collection of people making decisions, often in a herd-like manner, that they hope will prove profitable. But it is no less true of economies and companies. They may seem like independent, well-oiled machines, but they too are nothing but groups of people making decisions, with all that implies. The first time rookie investors see this phenomenon occur, it's understandable that they might accept that something that has never happened before, the cessation of cycles, could happen. But the second time or the third time, those investors, now experienced, should realize it's never going to happen, and turn that realization to their advantage. The next time you're approached with a deal predicated on cycles having ceased to occur, remember that invariably, it's a losing bet. The most important thing. I was 22 years old and a newcomer to investing in 1968, the time of my initial exposure to the Nifty 50. People far more experienced than I was held forth regarding the company's greatness, their boundless potential for growth, the fact that nothing bad could ever happen to them, and thus the absence of any limits on their stock prices. I swallowed those stories. At any rate, I don't remember pushing back on the illogicality of their extremeness. Thus, I was lucky to learn my first lessons regarding cyclicality, value, and risk at an early age, and with relatively little bet on the erroneous concepts. I was a little less naive when I organized Citibank's response to the Arab oil embargo of 1973, when the price of oil went from $20 a barrel to $60, and energy analysts saw few impediments to continued increases. And when the wonders of computers led to the formation of far more disk drive companies in the 1980s than would turn out to be needed. But later, with a few decades of experience under my belt, I was able to recognize the excesses of the tech internet e-commerce bubble of the late 1990s and of the unquestioning capital market behavior that ultimately led to the global financial crisis of 2007 to 08. This learning process regarding excesses in the markets and their contribution to cycles is an indispensable part of every investor's education. The tendency of people to go to excess will never end, and thus, since those excesses eventually have to correct, neither will the occurrence of cycles. Economies and markets have never moved in a straight line in the past, and neither will they do so in the future. And that means investors with the ability to understand cycles will find opportunities for profit. Chapter 18. The Essence of Cycles. I'm going to conclude by pulling together some of the book's paragraphs that I think hold the keys to understanding cycles, their genesis, and how they should be dealt with. I'll alter them only as necessary, to allow them to stand alone here, out of context. This won't be a summary of the book, but rather a recap of some of its key observations. And for those who wish, reading just the bolded sentences will provide a good synopsis of the recap. HM. Investment success is like the choosing of a lottery winner. Both are determined by one ticket, the outcome, being pulled from a bowl full of tickets, the full range of possible outcomes. In each case, one outcome is chosen from among the many possibilities. Superior investors are people who have a better sense for what tickets are in the bowl, and thus, for whether it's worth participating in the lottery. In other words, while superior investors, like everyone else, don't know exactly what the future holds, they do have an above-average understanding of future tendencies. The odds change as our position in the cycles changes. If we don't change our investment stance as these things change, we're being passive regarding cycles. In other words, we're ignoring the chance to tilt the odds in our favor. But if we apply some insight regarding cycles, we can increase our bets and place them on more aggressive investments when the odds are in our favor, and we can take money off the table and increase our defensiveness when the odds are against us. In my view, the greatest way to optimize the positioning of a portfolio at a given point in time is through deciding what balance it should strike between aggressiveness and defensiveness. And I believe the aggressiveness-defensiveness balance should be adjusted over time in response to changes in the state of the investment environment and where a number of elements stand in their cycles. The key word is calibrate. The amount you have invested, your allocation of capital among the various possibilities, and the riskiness of the things you own all should be calibrated